Hey Chicago, it's Nudia Hernandez from Vocalo. Taylor Bennett and A Damn Killer will be joining me for Vocalo's Summer Meltdown concert on July 11th at Bottom Lounge. It's free and the good vibes are endless. For more, head to wbez.org/events.
Hey Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. At the end of this podcast, stick around for a rundown of the latest news here in the Chicago area. But first, when you are sick and you've got to go to the hospital, you expect a nurse to be there when you need one, right? But a lot of nurses these days, they say staffing shortages and growing workloads are making that harder every single day. Now, healthcare workers across Chicago are organizing in record numbers for better working conditions and ultimately better patient care. It's part of a broader movement that's happening in hospitals and clinics across the country. So in this episode of The Pod, we're going to hear firsthand accounts from a couple of local nurses and a journalist who's been following their efforts. At the table was Jessica Ahn, a registered nurse in the emergency department at St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital in Ukrainian Village. Sarah Louise Dawson, who's a registered nurse in the Medical Intensive Care Unit at Rush University Medical Center, and Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ Public Health and Politics reporter. Now, right off the bat, I wanted to know what was the final straw that led these nurses on our panel to want to form a union. So here's Sarah Louise with her perspective.
Unionizing has been something that's been important to me since I became a nurse, and I think when we decided to file the petition, we were just like, the time is now. It's now or never. We've had enough of having more and more and more piled onto our plates, being asked to do more and more and more every shift with less support. And we just decided we have to do this now for the safety of ourselves and our colleagues. I'm tired of seeing people leave the bedside every year to go and do something else because the job's just not sustainable.
Mm. So doing more with less. Jessica, does that ring a bell?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly how we felt too. It was something that we always considered and talked about even when I first started. The experienced nurses around me had also educated me on union hospitals and what that would look like for us. And then to see those nurses leave the bedside, it just motivated me that, we had to keep that momentum going.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about the specific working conditions at St. Mary of Nazareth.
Well, currently or what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yes. So currently, the working conditions are exactly as you described. We have less, safe staffing. The demand for the workload is still there, so high patient volume. We have less resources and support that we had before.
And when you say high patient volume, tell me what that looks like for you on a shift, right? On a 12-hour shift or however your shifts are broken down. What does that mean for your night? What is your night going to look like when you see the patient load that you've got in front of you?
Mm-hmm. So when we do not have enough safe staffing, what that looks like is now there's longer wait times for patients in the waiting room. I see that their admission times are going to take longer because now the units are feeling the same pressure upstairs. I see that although the treatment plan for the patients are initiated in the emergency department, that continued care is being delayed as far as their admission goes, mm-hmm. and their next steps to recovery.
Yeah. Talk more, Sarah Louise, about what this looks like for patient care.
Yeah.
How does it impact the folks coming to you for help?
Totally. So I work in the ICU, so we often will get the really sick patients who end up in the emergency room. You know, people who are critically ill. And like Jessica said, we're working in different hospitals, but those ER wait times can really add up. And we know that when patients are stuck down in the ER for a long time, not that the ER nurses are not competent and capable, but they don't have the same staffing and resources that we have up in the ICU. So for an ICU, when we're short-staffed, it means often that we are feeling pressure to take more patients than is safe, which means that patients can't be watched as closely, which means that we're less able to be in the room with the patients, giving them that direct care. Obviously we want to make sure that things are as safe as possible for these patients, that they're getting the, medications they need on time, they're being able to be turned on time, we can respond to the call bells when they need to get up to use the bathroom on time. And when we don't have enough staff to do that, it makes it harder and harder and harder to do our job well and keep ourselves safe as well.
Before I bring you in here, Kristen, I want to hear from Jessica and Sarah Louise about burnout. What's that looking like for nurses?
So I think a great question. I think the answer for me is less about burnout because that feels like a deficiency in myself and more about moral injury. Like when I know that the excellent care that I want to deliver is like at a certain caliber and that I'm not being given the things that I need to do, the gap between the care that I want to deliver and the care that I'm able to deliver can cause a moral injury. It kills me to not be able to deliver the kind of care that I want to deliver to these patients. It is something that I like think about at night when I go home. And like that is something that I think is driving people away from like inpatient hospital nursing.
How are you thinking through burnout and managing it?
Yes,
Jessica?
I mean, great way to put it, Sarah. That is exactly how I feel as well. It's something that, you know, nurses take home with them when they know what kind of day they've had, and making sure that the patients are safe and that we are delivering high quality care on every shift. As far as management goes, I think that is why we continue to be stretched thin. You know, we're picking up those extra hours. We're picking up those extra shifts. We know what it's like for the previous shift or current shift to feel short. And you want to help the patients. You want to help the community. You want to help your colleagues. So you end up just stretching further and further to make all of that work.
Kristen, you've been following this story for a while. You've also been talking with Endeavor Health nurses. So talk to us about that and give us the very latest on their situation.
Yeah, so Endeavor is one of the biggest health systems in the Chicago area. It's a nonprofit. Nearly 3,000 nurses are trying to form a union with the Teamsters. So this, you know, Endeavor is a lot of hospitals. These nurses work at four of their hospitals. They're in the suburbs.
Okay.
So they, this spring, launched a pretty public campaign. They've got a pretty spicy Instagram page if people want to check that out. They also, similar to what we're talking about here, they want to form a union over what they say is really severe understaffing, worried about patient harm that could happen if they can't deliver meds on time, if they're juggling too many people, and pay cuts. You know, they see the executives at the health system receiving bonuses, while the nurses say their pay has been cut $5 to $22 an hour, which they tell me amounts to thousands of dollars a year.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, you attended a rally earlier this month in front of Endeavor's Evanston headquarters. It was organized by those nurses and Teamsters, as you mentioned. Trisha Peretta, she's one of the nurses who led the efforts. I want to play a little bit of what she had to say on that day.
Nursing is a calling. Dedication, though, it's not an unlimited resource. You can't run a hospital on burnout, and you can't solve the chronic, systemic understaffing by asking nurses to sacrifice even more.
And as you reported at the time, Kristen, Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia, he weighed in on the situation on nurses actually being fired for organizing. Tell us more about that and how Endeavor has responded. He wrote a letter to the CEO, didn't he?
Right. Yeah. He wrote a letter imploring them to reinstate two nurses who were fired. These were senior nurses working in the ICU, I believe, at Evanston Hospital. I will point out it is illegal for most private employers, including hospitals, to fire people for trying to form a union. Retaliation, intimidation, that's illegal. That's according to the National Labor Relations Board. You know, I have reached out to Endeavor several times to try and get an interview. I wrote about Congressman Garcia's letter. Mm-hmm. They have not responded to wanting to do an interview. In statements, they say, we respect the nurses, you know, trying to form a union, but that patient safety comes first.
Yeah.
What that means would be great to delve into a conversation on. But yes, that rally I attended, it was that, you know, people were taking up the sidewalk. It was loud. It was hours long. And then at the end, they went up to the front door of the headquarters to try and deliver a letter. The door was locked at first. Then someone came to the door, got their letter in there, over. But I don't see that effort ending anytime soon.
Now, Jessica and Sarah Louise, you heard that clip I just played of the nurse at Endeavor talking about how nursing is a calling. Why did you want to be a nurse? Why did you get into this profession, Jessica?
I wanted to become a nurse because I am surrounded by family members who are nurses, and they continue to encourage me to, you know, follow their lead as to what I could do to better the community. And care for people, you know. I think it's within my nature to always want to be there and help, and they saw that in me and always told me that healthcare is the direction to go, but that nursing specifically was the right route.
It was the right fit for you. Do you feel that way now?
I do. Even now, I love my profession. That's why I'm so strong about the union, because I do care about the work that I do and the high quality patient care that I want to provide. So overall, you know, nursing is my profession and I'm proud of my profession, but that shouldn't be a sacrifice.
Yeah, you want to stick to doing that calling, right? What about you, Sarah Louise? What brought you to this profession?
I knew that I wanted to be a nurse, actually when I was in paramedic school and I got to see a baby born for the first time, like got to see a delivery, and I was like, oh, I want to do this and I got to get in here right now. So I like did my thing, got my prerequisites, went to nursing school. And I think similarly to you, like wanting to help my community members, wanting to be part of something bigger than myself. I think a lot of nurses come to nursing because we want to help people. I think a lot of people come to medicine because they want to help people. Mm-hmm. And I think nursing is such a cool way to do that, because you're like, you are the hands and eyes and ears in the room with the patient in like the best moments and also the worst moments. And it is such an honor to be able to be there and do that. I agree with everything you said. I love my profession, and I think the best way to ensure the integrity of my profession and the integrity of my care is through our efforts, like with the union, with National Nurses United.
Mm-hmm. There's also been talk among nurses about wanting to have more decision-making power. What would that look like, do you think? I mean, and how are decisions around patient care being made right now?
I think the way that we want to see happen is that nurses have, I think a seat at the table is like a phrase that you'll hear a lot, a seat at the table to be able to say like, hey, like we see that this is what's happening. I think sometimes what can happen is that management or leadership will make a decision and say like, hey, we think this should be done this way now. And it's like, okay, cool. But did you like talk to anyone about that? Did you make sure these things are happening? And at a surface level, in my experience, that something like that happens at Rush. But eventually someone at the top can just say like, no, thanks. We don't want to do it that way. It's too expensive to do it that way. And so we want to be able to say like, hey, this isn't our contract. We negotiated over this and you have to get like our buy-in in order to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, we know that now, you know, in 2026, it's been more than 6 years since the COVID lockdown began. Many of us remember that great strain that was put on healthcare workers. Remember the phrase essential workers, right? That's what you were considered at the time. That's what you still are. but I wonder how the pandemic continues, you think, to impact this profession, nursing, years later. Are there still trickle-down effects?
Yes. I mean, the issues that we're seeing now were still present prior to the pandemic. During the pandemic is when it was just exposed and then accelerated for the public to see the major issues going on within the healthcare systems. As far as how it's still affecting everybody now, I mean, yes, at that time we were considered essential heroes, and what we're asking for now is that we're still considered essential and that we're part of making these essential decisions that affect our patient care and high quality care.
It's not just nurses, Kristen, who are unionizing lately. We've been seeing these organizing efforts across the country from other healthcare professionals, right?
Yeah. So resident doctors and fellows. So resident doctors are doctors who graduated medical school and are in training. They are unionizing at the University of Chicago. They are joining residents who have unionized at UIC, and Northwestern. And a lot of the same issues we're talking about here, you know, low pay, residents tend to work pretty grueling hours, like 80 hours a week. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about burnout. Mm-hmm. So really just pay and you know, feeling valued and respectful. That's what they want.
Have doctors at your hospitals been supportive of unionizing efforts? You're nodding, Jessica.
Yes, I'm nodding yes, that they are extremely supportive. They've seen us over the decades and the work that we're providing and know that we deserve a seat at the table and our voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we work really closely with resident doctors and fellows, like very, very closely. We like obviously are team members with them. We collaborate a lot on patient care, and it's been really exciting to see some of my colleagues who are physicians say, like, hey, like, that's really great. We're really excited for you. Like, keep going. We had a fellow who was like, oh, you're wearing red. That's my favorite color. And we were like, oh, thank you.
Right, right. Yeah. No, that's great. And we've brought up in the short time quite a few sort of different reasons why you're speaking out, why you're doing this. If you had to sum up what exactly nurses need to allow you to do your job, right, give patients the best care, what would you say is the overall ultimate message here, Sarah Louise?
I think the ultimate message is, like, trust nurses, right? Like, we have experience and training, and we are, the hands, eyes, and ears doing the care. And we know that, like, hey, it's much harder for me to do my job well, to do it at the level of excellence that I want to do it at, when I don't have someone here to help me, when I have too many patients in front of me, when people are sicker and sicker and sicker without extra help.
Yeah.
And that is really what it is to me. It's like, trust nurses, help us to do our job well, and, like, put that in writing so that we know that it can't be taken away from us. I think you were asking about the trickle-down effects from the COVID pandemic, and I think we did a lot with limited resources, and unfortunately, I think a lot of, like, administration and healthcare said, like, oh, well, you can do it that way, so just keep doing it that way, and that's not what we want to be doing.
Well, I was inspired listening to you, Jessica, talk about one of the reasons why you did this. You talked about, you know, it kind of running in the family, and just it being in your nature, wanting to help people. And I think of my daughter who just got accepted to nursing school.
Yay, congratulations. Yes.
That's what she's doing. She's 18 and she's diving in, because we always told her the same thing, like, oh, this is a perfect lane for you. She is a little bit discouraged when she hears about some of these realities. So what would you say to not just her, but other young people interested in getting into nursing right now?
For those who are interested, you know, I want to say not to be scared. There's not only the patient care aspect, but, you know, you need to be willing to speak out when there are concerns. And a part of caring for your patients and caring for your profession is also making sure that it's being done the right way, to use your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are someone who, you know, like your daughter, cares for people and then also has a voice, then that's the perfect combination.
So. Yeah, that's definitely her. Real quick, Kristen, tell me what you're going to keep an eye on as this wave of unionization continues.
Well, I want to see how, you know, what happens at the hospitals where nurses are unionizing. We're going to check and see on what happens at Endeavor. I will just say, too, you know, for that this is not a new issue, right? I know we're talking about all the latest action, but these complaints about understaffing, low pay, have been happening for years.
Right.
And one of the reasons why hospitals have resisted this across the state and, well, across the country, you know, is that they say that they would, you know, it lacks flexibility if they can't. No, they don't want a one-size-fits-all approach, right, when we talk about, like, safe staffing ratios. So I'm going to keep watching all of this. You know, are there going to be other hospitals where nurses are unionizing and other types of workers, too?
Yeah. Kristen Schorsch is a WBEZ public health and politics reporter. Jessica Ahn is an RN with St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital. And Sarah Louise Dawson is an RN at Rush. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Turn to the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. We checked in with two of our WBEZ colleagues, Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and reporter and anchor Araceli Gomez Aldana. Claire kicked things off with an overview of how the Chicago Bulls did in last night's NBA draft. Here she is.
The Bulls were making moves last night in the first round, we should say, of the NBA draft. They had the fourth pick, and I think they had the 15th pick overall. and they went with a forward, Caleb Wilson, which is going to be confusing.
Yes, I was
for news
that.
Anchors that aren't from this city.
Oh, that's
potentially
right. Caleb Wilson or Caleb Williams. Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Different sport, same city.
Different sport, yeah. Same first name, different, or same last name, different first name. This is Caleb Wilson from the University of North Carolina, so he's a Tar Heel, and guard Dalen Swain from Texas, where there were two picks last night. Wilson, kind of a defensive powerhouse, strong in the paint. Sasha, he protects the rim. He's a rebounder.
Oh, yeah.
And
we need that on the Bulls.
We do. Girl, we really what do. Don't we need on the Bulls? But Swain averaged about 17.3 points per game last season, but he did only shoot about 34.4% from three-point range. So he's going to need some work around the three-point line. But as we know, this is the first draft for Bulls' new executive VP, Bryson Graham, and for new head coach, Tiago Splitter. Splitter says the team is establishing a defensive identity.
Yeah,
so we'll see about that.
This is a good place for him to grow and potentially, you know, reach his full potential here in Chicago. So it's going to be exciting to watch.
And the second round of the draft, if you do feel like partaking, Sasha, is tonight at 7 o'clock if you want to set your alarm.
Yeah, we'll do. Now, from the Bulls to the Bears, Araceli, because our governor, Pritzker, he's still not giving up. He's trying to keep this football team in Illinois.
Yes. You know, if you ask Hammond residents, it's pretty much they're like, they're coming here. But Pritzker's like, not so fast. So Pritzker's hoping that there's still a possibility to iron out a deal to keep the Bears in Illinois. And that's before the legislature meets in the fall. He says his office has been giving the team advice on this new stadium plan after two prior proposals didn't go anywhere. Mm. He says if a compromise can be ironed out, he for sure is willing to call a special session to pass this plan, but we don't know.
Yeah, well, let's hear from Governor Pritzker himself.
We want to get it done as soon as possible, and if they're able to put everything together as we hope they will, you know, I'm willing to call a special session so that we can get a vote on it long before the veto session, if that's possible.
So Pritzker also says Illinois is still as close as anybody to getting a stadium done.
Interesting.
That was a quote. Even though the Bears board of directors voted earlier this month, we'll remember, to move forward with the project in Hammond, got all of us shook. We thought it was a done deal. I'm just, I need the stadium to land somewhere.
Well, they can certainly move forward with building whatever they want to build in Indiana. It's just not necessarily going to be where the home of the Bears is.
Right.
I mean, that's sort of the other side of it. That's kind of what happened in Arlington Heights.
That's true.
So I think that this goes to show you, though, that the Bears continue to play all sides. Of the field.
And we have a very hopeful governor. That's what that tells me as well. Sticking to Pritzker for a bit, he's also expected to sign new legislation. This is to protect some patient medical information. Fill us in, Claire.
That's right. So this is legislation that would continue to bolster Illinois' status as a haven for abortion care across the Midwest. Pritzker expected to sign this bill today. This was approved in the spring session. But as you said, it protects patient information from states that criminalize abortion. As you know, in Illinois, we do not. So this allows patients to keep certain reproductive health procedures or any information, like if they had an abortion, from being shared when receiving medical care from a new provider, or maybe they move out of state and they get a new doctor. So patients can also decide to disclose the private information to their new providers if they want, but this just protects them if, you know, they decide that they don't want to do that. So Pritzker, you know, continuing just to protect abortion access here in Illinois and patient information.
One of the few states in the area.
Yes. Very true. Still a safe haven for folks, especially
in
neighboring states. Now, another story that we're following, Araceli, sounds like Illinois libraries are getting a much needed boost.
That's right. And that, you know, Secretary of State Alexi Janulis says that $27 million in grants are going to go out to help public libraries and public schools. So through expanded programs like buying materials, upgraded infrastructure, things like that, $2 million of that will go towards equalization grants. So I thought that was interesting. Money to help public libraries that don't have a large property tax base, right? Oh. So sometimes, you know, those go hand in hand and they don't want to leave anybody behind. You know, this is going to affect about 640 libraries.
Mm. Well, let's hear what Illinois Secretary of State Janulis had to say about this funding.
Protecting the right to read means more than just defending books from censorship. It means ensuring that libraries have the resources to keep their doors open, their shelves stocked, and their services available to everyone.
So what's the money expected to be used for exactly?
You know, I think that a lot of it is going towards, like I said, these programs and things. But I will say that for eligibility purposes, they do have to adhere to the American Library Association's Bill of Rights. So that prevents things like removal of materials based on political or ideological differences. So a lot of people saw that as a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring it back to Chicago. Mayor Brandon Johnson's teaming up with other mayors. What's he doing?
He loves teaming up with other mayors, which I think is outstanding. But he is part of a pact of 40 mayors, and this is global, who want to shape how urban data centers, not just how they're being used, but how they're being built. So from their inception, they're calling it their vision for how urban data center development can be done in a more sustainable way and not at the expense of our cities, their cities, natural resources, energy prices, which we know we are seeing soaring in the Chicago area. This is called C40 Cities, an alliance of nearly 100 cities seeking to impact climate change. And it launched yesterday in London. Mayors from here in Chicago, as we know, of Phoenix, Arizona, even Melbourne, Australia, getting involved in this.
What other stories are on your radar?
This is kind of big news from an architectural standpoint and also just accessibility standpoint, but this is the south entrance of the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry. It is going to reopen for the first time in more than a century.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Sun Times reporting the museum is adding a renovated outdoor terrace with seating, also a new indoor cafe, but the overhaul is really making this access point, this entry point, very ADA accessible. So it's going to be welcoming to all four wheels, two wheels, no wheels. A lobby elevator is also going to sort of be at the marquee of this, leading to the museum's portico level, also the main cafe. And the exterior steps on the south entrance are also going to be totally restored. So the project, kind of a big price tag with it, $22 million. But in the name of accessibility, and it should be completed, Sun Times reporting, by 2027.
And a throwback to history, right?
Very true, yeah. And there's some renderings of this, sometimes.com, if you want to take a look.
I love Libe's headline, Backdoor No More.
Exactly.
Very cool. Araceli, Chicago City Council talks a lot about this so-called teen takeovers.
Right.
We've talked a lot about them, certainly here on WBEZ. Basically, we're talking about those large meetups of teenagers. Now the council is going straight to the source to find solutions.
Right, which I think is a good idea, right? Let's talk to them. So there's this subcommittee, the Youth Employment Committee, and they're holding a hearing today so they can hear from teens. They want to hear about things like jobs, access to safe spaces, recent large youth gatherings. Like you said, we've been hearing so much about these so-called teen takeovers. They've dominated conversations among news and city council. Even last week, if you remember, Sasha, the city council rejected a measure to punish parents if their child participates in these so-called teen takeovers. Alderman Raymond Lopez attempted to put that out there. That was rejected. But it's going to be interesting to hear from teens. That's today at 10:30. And I hope teens show up.
I hope so, too.
It's a little early.
Make your voices heard.
That's right.
WBEZ's Claire Lane and Araceli Gomez-Aldana.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.